All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, May 31st, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a lovely 66 degrees and just starting to sprinkle a little bit here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show D.O.D., Fort Detrick, WMDs, 21st Century Cures, Executive Order, and Global quote-unquote security. And I think that about sums it up. We took a look at the connecting dots from Fort Detrick, Maryland, where they had spearheaded the U.S. biowarfare program that had continued up until Nixon inked that agreement, but we found out of a New York Times article from 1982 that apparently is online as part of the archives, that just as we had always postulated in that one sentence where Richard Nixon had stated that we were going to maintain a defensive posture against our enemy's potential bioterror through vaccines. Well, that story qualified everything we had said, because that's exactly what they did. And not only were they tinkering with mad science gone mad vaccines that, you know, end up in your child, but we find out that they started back in 1982 and before already on gene editing down dark hallways with screams and bloody handprints. And the public was not aware of that at all. So when we take a look at the trajectory that things have taken in the last 35 years, we had the advent of GMO foods, and now we have the sequencing of the human genomes. They've also sequenced bacterial genomes, and we've gone way, way back. Through a bacillus bacteria, we spent 2 weeks looking at bacteria and different things that they are doing to bacteria, some of the dangers of some of these quote-unquote probiotic bacterias, these living therapeutics that they are developing with the aid of Georgie Porgy Church and some of the Ivy League universities, including MIT, Harvard. And they have their combined conglomerate Weiss Institute that receives quite a bit of DARPA funding, that they have been creating these little microbes, quote unquote, that are good for you, that potentially in the future, 21st century cures will be able to go in your gut, won't even hurt Johnny, and just nibble on this banana or this yogurt stick. And we will be able to cure everything that ails you. Not only will this get inside of you, but it also might be able to produce some sort of antibiotic if it senses danger, or it might be able to use one of its little micromotors and swim around inside of you and deliver a medicinal payload. This is what we're faced with here, people. And the problem with this is that this is just now coming to light with some of these bacillus bacteria, some of the things that they've already been doing to it, and some of the dangers now. This is one of those bacterias that is now showing up on the commercial storefront on all kinds of strange foods that you never would have seen before, that said with probiotics. Remember I told you, if it makes you raise an eyebrow, always pay attention, pull a little thread and see what you find. This is how, I mean, who knew? Who knew? It was because I saw it on a box of tea one day and I thought, what? I mean, this is just, the more we dig, of course, everything always goes back to some sort of mad science insanity and human experimentation and things happening under the covers. But it gets even worse. You know, as now we tie in the Brain Initiative, again, another thing that Obama inked an executive order, or I don't know, maybe it was just a national initiative, but they had inked all kinds of money to go to all kinds of crazy research to be able to reverse engineer biology, whether it be our genetic makeup or our neuronal pathways. Or the third big investment was in artificial intelligence, which has a big crossover, not only to the neurobiology that is being cracked at the moment, learning everything there is to know about the human brain, but they are also using this project to reverse engineer our gray matter, all in the hopes of creating some sort of synthetic pulsating brain that might be able to help us on the back end. Of course, we have things such as Dr. Watson, who is now curing cancer and learning genomics. And I think today we're going to kind of hop into some of that. One of the things, you know, how this ties back to this whole bacterial insanity. So we also discovered that they now have a programming language for cells. And they're able to literally go in, flip switches on and off, insert or remove biological material, even infect bacteria with bacterial viruses. Those are those phages. And those viruses could be programmed to do certain things or to be a secret payload. You know, we need to really be concerned about what is around us and in our surroundings. You know, it's only a matter of time, in my honest opinion, before something accidentally or on purpose escapes some of these creepy little labs that are now sprinkled all across the world with the advent of CRISPR being democratized. And if you think about how large a microbe is, and then you think about how many surfaces our shoes simply come into contact with on a daily basis, our fingertips come into contact, our backs or our book bags or purses, our jackets, gloves. It's really horrifying. And we travel. We have international travel. Something could have potentially gotten out in some discreet offshore, not U.S.-funded, wink, laboratory, and traveled back with some young, strapping buck who joined the public health service agencies, one of the many. And they're coming home for the holidays. They get one day off. They let them out of their secret labs to go home and see the family. And all it's going to take is one bacterial spore. And remember, these spores, these bacillus spores especially, of which anthrax happens to be a part of that family, these spores are very, very hard to kill. Radiation won't kill them. Neither will chemical compounds most times. I'm hoping, you know, I wanted to look into bleach. Gotta love bleach. But we found out even UV. UV for hospitals is what they've been working on now. Though, I don't know, I'm calling some question. If someone wants to look into it, how they are flying bacteria up to space. And I saw there was space bacillus too. I forgot to send you that, Camille. Somewhere here I have it open. But there were some experiments they were doing with bacillus in space as well. And, you know, if UVC is such a good antimicrobial, then how are these bacteria being flown to space for experimentation not dying when they are outside of the Earth's quote-unquote ozone layer, the ozone layer that they are saying is thinning now that is causing UVC to get down to the planet? Big question, homework question for you guys. We ended the show yesterday looking at hospitals and a project that they had been running in Chicago. I don't remember the name of that hospital. Maybe they'll mention it in here. Whatever that big Chicago hospital is, isn't that the county hospital? They're very, very busy in Chicago. We know lots of violence going on in Chicago at times. During a hospital stay, all microbial hell breaks loose between you and the room. The reason why I thought this was so important is because, yes, we know there's a lot of antibiotic-resistant super bacteria existing in hospitals now because of the use of antibiotics and different medications and things. But they have also been able to map germs across the New York City subway and in other different projects they've been looking at across large cities like New York City with biosensors and things of that nature to see how things are transmitted. You know that they have been looking at that Pandemic X through DARPA, and they know with a flip of a few switches, whether accidentally or on purpose, it will take something that maybe was not necessarily innocuous, but maybe it was a couple days you were sick and then it was over. They are tinkering with how to make things that maybe weren't as killer, more killer, just because they want to see what happens and try to get a leg up, they say. I'm being able to combat something even nastier, but don't worry about it, because that's where the shape-shifting immune system, live on the fly, gene editing comes in with some of this CRISPR pill, this CRISPR quote-unquote antibiotic. It really isn't an antibiotic. It starts snipping away at DNA strands while inside of you, led by a little guide that they had programmed into the bacteria and then launched inside of your body. Well, my point in this is we are exposed to bacteria on a daily basis, and it's everywhere. And every time you go into a public place, I don't want to turn anyone into a germaphobe, but if there ever was a time for some sort of germophobia, it might be now. Because even though we can't see it, can't touch it, can't smell it, can't taste it, remember, I've told you this a million times, doesn't mean it isn't there. And we've been kind of digging into a lot of the science that is going on right now with lots of taxpayer dollars and funding, as well as rich tech billionaires and people who believe that our planet is overpopulated as well. Bill Gates had called out the other, I don't think that was the other day. It might have even been a few months ago, but I had it queued up for us for the other day about how, yes, the next pandemic is coming within 10 or 15 years. But remember, they've already primed the pump with Ebola, Zika, with flying vaccinators, except those are the flying disease carriers. But one day, mosquitoes will be flying vaccinators, thanks to Japan. We have all this stuff going on, and Bill Gates says, yeah, one day it's going to knock out 30 million people or so. So don't worry about it. In less than a year, step right up. Get your CRISPR antibiotic or your shape-shifting immune system. We will make certain that you will be protected against anything known or unknown, and especially in this world where we have competing countries, biowarfare program, quote-unquote, defensive biowarfare programs. And we have rogue agents and little Johnny in mommy's back bedroom in the garage, DIYing, gene editing, with their DIY CRISPR kit. It's going to get more and more prevalent. Well, in the first few hours of a hospital stay, the microbes living on the walls and other surfaces of a hospital try to overthrow your skin's microbiome. But then all hell breaks loose, and within 24 hours, and possibly as little as just 7 hours, your microbes rise up to beat back the invaders of that room. And before the germ clouds settle, your microbiome has actually invaded that room. At least that seems to be the standard way of things, according to a new study in Science Translational Medicine. For the study, researchers at the University of Chicago, led by microbiologist Jack Gilbert, meticulously tracked the microbial comings and goings of a new hospital over the course of a year. They started from before the hospital opened and kept researching back when it was full of patients and the researchers set out to understand microbial dynamics so that they can one day tweak them. Gilbert envisions future probiotics, not pills or lotions, but surface sprays and wall treatments that can bulk up beneficial bacteria capable of ejecting deadly pathogens and even prime helpful immune defenses in patients from the walls, guys. Look out. Remember when we first started looking at shape-shifting everything? Just do a quick search of shape-shifting DARPA in Google. You're going to find all kinds of strange things. They've been working on shape-shifting buildings and living building materials, houses that'll be able, having some sort of biology built into them, be able to react to their environment. They would be considered quote-unquote smart, except smart from a biological perspective. Just a very frightening thing. So now we're going to have hospital walls. They're actually living organisms, and they will be able to invade you with, quote-unquote, beneficial bacteria when you move in for your stay and boost your immune system. We know that generally cleanliness or hygiene in a hospital is a good thing, Gilbert told Ars Technica, which is the publication I'm reading this out of. But what if we were missing a trick? What if there are actually changes in the hospital microbiome environment which could actually be beneficial? It sounds a bit far-fetched, he acknowledges, but it is not something that is too far away from reality. Now, if they're already talking about this, like, in the public, in a hospital, what have they been doing that we don't know about? What have they been testing stuff on to see how microbes interact in the environment for 50 years, 35 years at least? Since we read the New York Times publication in 82, but remember this was going on long before the New York Times ever got a scoop. In this new study, Gilbert and his team started chipping away at the big question. They swiped and surveyed microbes from the nooks and crannies of patients and of staff. That's pretty horrifying. Then they similarly swabbed hospital fixtures starting 2 months before the hospital opened in February of 2013. And surface samples came from two nurses' stations, 10 patient rooms, and they were split evenly across the surgical floor of the hospital and the floor with hematology and oncology departments. The researchers wiped bed rails, walls, floors, chairs, phones, faucets, and air filters, as well as computer mice, shoes, and countertops. And they also kept track of conditions in the hospital, such as temperature, humidity, and lighting. All the rooms were cleaned daily with an ammonium solution and then with bleach between patients. And a year later, they had 6,523 microbial samples to sequence and analyze. Before the hospital opened, the microbiomes of the building materials, marked by an Acinetobacter, I'll spell it, anyone wants to look it up, Acinetobacter, as well as Pseudomonas, quietly roamed the hall. The researchers found, but once opened, a tidal wave of human skin microbes swept in, completely overturning the communities. Skin-associated groups, including cornea bacterium, staphylococcus, and streptococcus, which will be your flesh-eating bacterias if they get to be supercharged, reigned for the rest of the study. In terms of people and their microbes, the researchers found some unsurprising links. The microbes on the hands of the staff most closely resembled those on their pagers and phones, for instance. Likewise, the microbes on the bed rails mirrored those on the patient's hands. But there were some surprises, too. Most notably, the microbial drama that seemed to unfurl when a patient settled into a hospital room. In the first few hours, the microbes from the room surfaces quickly encroached on the patient's skin. But by 24 hours, the proverbial tables turned and the patient's microbes seemed to regain their footing and began pouring in and taking over the room. The longer the stay, the more the two microbial camps melded together and marched toward an equilibrium point. Well, that's interesting because that's what happens in your body with all those different cultures. This data highlights, quote, this idea that you're constantly, they say, second time emphasis in italics, exchanging and interacting with the microbial world around you, Gilbert stresses. The data further hints that when nurses visit a patient, they can drop off microbes from their clothes that then cause another wiggle in the microbial balance. Because nurses often wear masks and gloves, their microbes didn't seem to be affected by the exchange. But for the patient camped out in their room, at a certain point, they're just exchanging their own microbes back and forth with themselves. So, you know, but think about this. So they're basically telling us that everywhere we go, we are being affected by people's microbes around us. We read that one story about obesity potentially being contagious. They were tying obesity back to some bad microbes in your gut. And then potentially stating that those microbes in your gut could be spread around through touch and environment with a group of people living together, where the people that live with you could potentially maybe also be influenced by those microbes. Well, after this hospital study, I'm starting to think a little more on the side of maybe they're just onto something. When you take a look at then some of the Bacillus bacteria and how Bacillus reproduces through a spore, and how those spores go dormant, and how those spores are excreted in things such as stool, and how they may potentially, through accidentally or on purpose, can be spread through having contact with fecal matter or things that have touched fecal matter. You could see how potentially it might be spread from somebody's gut. I mean, if anybody's ever lived in a household where you've had the stomach flu or the norovirus gone through your household, you will know that it might be a little difficult at times to make sure that you don't have any remaining microbial matter on your person. But anyway, now multiply that by 10 million on something like a New York City subway on a daily basis. I don't know if I'm ever going to ride the subway again if I go to New York. It's a pretty horrifying thought. I remember at one point back in the 90s, probably the early 90s when I was there, my sister lived there. It was back when she first moved there. And she told me, don't use a payphone. That was when payphones were still around because they found flesh-eating bacteria on them, which would be like Super MRSA even back in those days. So, all right. Well, they also found that warmer, more humid conditions seem capable of disturbing microbial balance. So those of you down in the warmer, more humid climates, like in the Gulf states, where they do have things such as flesh-eating bacteria in the Gulf of Mexico. I know over the last few years, we've found quite a number of stories. I was really surprised that some of those bacteria can actually live in salt water. That was like my first eyebrow raise. But I guess there are bacteria that live in salt water. Surprise. And I bet you even a bacillus might be able to, because they found that bacillus, 250-million-year-old bacillus in that Carlsbad cavern mine, right with the WIF facility with all the nuclear waste, that was living in the salt mines, literally. But that was in a dormant state, so I don't know in a live state. But anyway, I digress. But when researchers looked at the effects of the types of treatments that patients were undergoing, such as oral antibiotics, chemotherapy, surgery, etc., they did not see significant effects. The one exception was the use of topical antibiotics, which did squash microbial populations on the skin. And I linked to both of those links yesterday, but I'll put them again in the notes today. If anyone didn't read those studies, I had said where I found success with MRSA and things of that nature was with colloidal silver and with raw honey. And there are two National Institute of Health studies that show exactly what we've known for quite a long time. So don't let them fool you that you need some dangerous antibiotics that might have some long-term consequences, which there are quite a few out there now, so be careful. But anyway, so you got to think about hospitals, and it's like nobody wants to go to a hospital, but at some point, somewhere, we might end up there. I mean, I had a couple bouts over a 10-year period, and I'd never been in a hospital in my life. I'd never really even been sick, and then I got really sick for a really long time. But let's think of something else, somewhere else, that we might all go to at some point in a travel or whatever, and that would be a hotel room. You know, everyone's always said, ooh, hotel rooms are dirty, and they had some 60-minute expose. I don't know, it was one of those investigative mainstream shows where they would take an ultraviolet light, again, ultraviolet, shine it on different surfaces, and you can see the different stains and things that you can't see with the naked eye. Well, listen to this. Out of the CBC out of Canada, Huffington Post published it January 8th, 2013. Hotel rooms test to uncover high levels of contamination. A CBC Marketplace investigation has uncovered potentially dangerous levels of filth and contamination in hotel rooms across the country. In the largest ever survey of Canadian hotel cleanliness, Marketplace tested thousands of individual spots inside of hotel rooms at a wide spectrum of chains in Montreal, Vancouver, and Toronto. I used to go to Toronto, again, back in the 90s. There's a great place called the Bond Place, I think, right on, I don't even remember the main drag through the city. But if you ever go up there, it was kind of a nice place. And the nightly rate was only like $60 or something. So, and it was right behind Hard Rock Cafe, like on the strip. But anyway, and I liked it. It was a nice hotel. They took more than 800 high-touch spots in 54 different rooms in 6 different hotel chains. And the scientific analysis found high levels of contamination creating potentially hazardous conditions for guests. This is like insane. So you think like they're hosing down your hotel room with bleach and they're putting all those bedspreads through the washing machine each time somebody leaves. Well, guess what? Doesn't quite sound like it. Guelph University microbiologist Keith Waringer conducted the test for Marketplace, and he found alarming results. Quote, "I wasn't expecting bacteria to be so prolific," he said. "I was really surprised at the lack of sanitation." Maids make it look nice, but they're not making it sanitary, which is totally different, unquote. Waringer tested common hotspots in hotel rooms using an adenosine triphosphate ATP measuring device, and that is the energy in a cell that determines the microbial contamination on surfaces. A scan of any surface gauges the level of contamination with a simple numerical value, employing a scale used in similar tests in schools and in offices. An ATP level under 300 is considered a pass, while anything between 300 and 999 is considered to be in the caution zone, and an ATP level over 1,000 is deemed a big fat F. Marketplace found that comforters, ding, bathroom faucets, and TV remote controls were the 3 top dirtiest spots in hotel rooms. Comforters were the most consistently contaminated spots, rating a fail in 23 out of the 51 tests, or nearly half. The highest contamination count for a comforter was found in a Super 8 in Montreal with a reading of 26,124 ATP level. Oh, that's horrifying. Though doctors recommend proper hand washing to protect yourself from illness, don't sit on the comforter. Faucets in hotel rooms were quite dirty themselves, with 16 fails out of 54, or a failure rate of 30%. The Holiday Inn in Toronto had the highest contamination count for a faucet at 11,374 ATP level. You know, and what's scary is Toronto is like an international city. They have an international airport, and a downtown hotel would be probably pretty busy, I would imagine, especially if it were a name chain that is worldwide. This was pretty horrifying. And if you have some of these larger chains having some of this grade level F contamination, imagine what some of these second rate chains are like. My last trip a few years ago, when it must have been already 4 going on 5 years ago, if you guys can even believe it, when I went down to New Mexico and across Arizona to Vegas to visit my friend, we had stopped one night in a hotel. I think it might have been in Arizona, and it was some cheapie. I mean, we had driven a good part of the night, and we just wanted to get there, you know, but it was a little late, and it was dark, and we were all tired, so we're like, yeah, so let's just get a cheap hotel, couple beds, and we'll crash out for a few hours, and then we'll hit the road in the morning. And we went in there, and it was like a trucker hotel. You know, it was like one, you had all kinds of trucks parked. And we go in, and my friend pulls the sheet down on one bed, and there's like 4 big, curly, nasty, like chest or back hairs in the sheet, like all woven through the sheet. It was disgusting. And so she called down and she demanded fresh sheets for the bed. But I mean, just think about that for a minute. This is horrifying. And then you got to think about like even the microbes, and if not even microbes, like bed bugs. You know, New York City has this epidemic of bed bugs, and they have for quite a long time. We covered a story a while back where they were even talking about potentially using gene drives and CRISPR to genetically modify bed bugs to help eliminate them, just like they're talking about with the mosquitoes and some of Bill Gates, Georgie Porgy Church's combined handiwork there. Just think about that. Think about what we are surrounded by. Think about now we have that DARPA Insect Allies program where they can influence the insects with genetically modified bacteria that have potentially been infected by genetically modified phages or bacterial virus. I mean, guys, our woods are full of ticks. Our woods are full of ticks loaded with Lyme disease and now this PASWAN that causes death and neurological deficits and no cure. They don't even know like how to deal with it. We have all these weird things going on in the woods and in our environment and in our air and our water. Remember, we found that one little puddle in Colorado. They found like, I don't know, 73 new branches on the tree of microbial life just in a puddle one day off at the end of a little stream that was started up near Rocky Flats, where they're doing a lot of the nuclear testing. Just saying, you know, mutation accidentally or on purpose in our natural world could cause us some potential big problems in the future from a bunch of different pathways. All these micro ecosystems, I think, would be the best way to refer to them, whether it be the insects and the plants and the trees or the microbes, or all of them working together, because we also have the microbes in the soil, which is where Bacillus bacteria live mostly. But now let's get to our hotel room. I know everybody's going to be staying in a hotel this weekend and not thinking of me. He says, yeah, the comforters in particular can pose a threat two guests. When we step into a bed, we are exposing our bodies to it, and we're there for a long time. This poor comforter is getting exposed to all these different people who are depositing their microbes, and you are acquiring theirs. It is a significant transfer route. Intimate exposure to highly contaminated areas, like in a bed or a toilet seat, is particularly dangerous, he warned. Now, you remember when you were a kid? They always told us, don't worry about it. You can't catch AIDS or STDs from a toilet seat. Well, this is actually a scientist now saying, whoops. He didn't say AIDS or STDs, but most certainly dangerous microbes and dangerous microbes from other people. And who the hell knows who? That could be passed along through these intimate, quote unquote, intimate surfaces. Intimate exposure to highly contaminated areas, like in a bed or a toilet seat, is particularly dangerous, he warned, as it could lead, in rare cases, to myriad illnesses, including urinary tract infections, or really sexually transmitted diseases. Ding, la, 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 ding. You know, and it makes you wonder, I mean, there's bacteria and stuff like chlamydia. I don't know. I never looked into it. I don't know what type of bacteria it is, but I wonder if things like that could remain dormant. You know, if especially if it was in a busy hotel with a quick turnover, and they just kind of straighten things up, and you just finish your business before you checked out. You know, from that 11 a.m. to 3 p.m. is only a 4 or 5 hour window. You know, conditions could be just ripe in a hotel room to incubate, percolate in the fiber. I'm just saying. I don't know, guys. This is really kind of horrifying. Because who even pays attention? So this scientist, Waringer, also used an ultraviolet light to search for stains otherwise invisible to the naked eye. Used in rooms that otherwise appeared to be clean, he discovered stains that could either be from urine or beer or other organic material. Wink. He also looked at a coffee maker covered in so much organic material that it appeared to not have ever been cleaned at all. Oh, God. Have a little microbe in your first cup. And a pillow with so much bacteria that it had, quote, its own life story, unquote. Oh, how much of a barf is that? My friend and I were talking the other day about how we like to bring our own pillows. And I've always been like that. Though it's hard if you're flying, you only have so much room, so you're not going to pay $75 to check an extra bag so you can bring your pillow. But I don't know. Maybe you want to. This is really horrifying. And a blow-up mattress as well. So there's a chance that guests do get sick, he said. It's just that they don't realize that it's the hotel bed that they were sleeping on or the coffee maker. It just goes on to illustrate that looks can really be deceiving. Waringer was also surprised that high-end hotels were no cleaner than the budget hotels, except for maybe the 4 chest hairs when you pull down the covers. Budget hotels also had some of the cleanest bathrooms in the study. And remember, that's probably what sells them, where people can get a $60 room. And when they walk in, they smell bleach and they go, ooh, this is a nice, clean, cheap hotel. But the top-end hotels, they all really performed equally as bad, so don't worry about it. Best Western had among the best results, where some of the dirtiest surfaces were found in something called Fairmount. I think I remember that logo. And if you're going to pay the extra money for a top-end hotel, don't expect to have better sanitation. Bring your own bottle of bleach. I wonder if the TSA allows bleach. Overburdened hotel staff is the main reason that these rooms are so filthy, they say. And longtime housekeeper Bridget Ruiz, who has worked in Toronto for 21 years says that housekeepers have an extensive test list for cleaning each room, but rarely have enough time to complete it. She said she would finish 16 rooms perfectly because, oh, she wouldn't finish 16 rooms perfectly because there were so many steps that you needed to follow. And if they want it to be spotless, that will take so much time. They are underpaid, overtime, to reach their daily targets, but they still use time-saving shortcuts like not dusting or vacuuming or obviously washing the bedspreads. All right, so if I haven't horrified you enough, we looked at a story the other day. Elon Musk, in one of his many pursuits, was sending up a SpaceX rocket back in February. And on SpaceX, he was sending some antibiotic-resistant MRSA to the space station with the aid of a company named Cambridge, a company out of Cambridge named NanoBioSim, looking to see what the effects of near zero gravity would be on the superbug, and then see if they can find a more efficient way to kill it with some of this new technology. Some of the new technology that they are using is CRISPR and artificial intelligence. You know, they are able to now sequence very quickly with some of these genome sequencers that Craig Venter spearheaded. He is actually in a business deal with DARPA as well. But they are working on creating production lines of DNA and genome sequencing. We've talked about cells being able to be programmed. Well, as part of this whole thing, don't forget, they got the big super pulsating brain now in the background to help them sequence genomes to take a look at diseases as well as bacteria. Try to find a match. Try to find the chinks in the armor of not only the organism, like how to kill it, but also of humans and how to quote-unquote cure us. We read a story. I don't remember which one it was. We read a lot of stuff yesterday. Oh, actually, it was out of the 1982 New York Times article looking at Fort Detrick and the colonel that was in charge. And he was discussing how, yes, these technologies in gene editing in particular can not only cure, but they can also kill. Well, we're not going to be able to kill as well until we get a smarty pants computer. So a story out of March 8th, 2016, Scientific American. And I didn't know about the name of this project, but guess we do now. The U.S. government launched just over a year ago a $100 million, quote, Apollo project of the brain. This intelligence project aims to reverse engineer the brain, ding-a-ling-a-ling-a-ling, to find algorithms that allow computers to think more like humans. 3 decades ago, the U.S. government launched the Human Genome Project. Ding, ding. Exactly what we've been talking about that has led to where we are today, with CRISPR being considered a WMD. And it was a 13-year endeavor to sequence and map all genes of the human species. And remember, they've also launched projects to do insects as well as plants and microbes. Although initially met with skepticism and even opposition, the project has since transformed the field of genetics and is today considered one of the most successful scientific enterprises. Yeah, it's going to make bazillions in history. Now, someone you haven't heard of much, the Intelligence Advanced Research Project Activity, or agency, like we call it, or more affectionately known as IARPA, which is a research organization for the intelligence community, modeled after the Defense Department's famed, love to hate them, DARPA, has dedicated $100 million to a similarly ambitious project of what? Oh, reverse engineering the brain. Now, who is IARPA? Well, according to their own website, IARPA is the CIA's newest directorate that consolidates several technology business units into one hub organization focused on deeply embracing innovative approaches and capabilities throughout the agency. Although the Office of the Director of National Intelligence conducts its own research, beginning with the Intelligence Advanced Research Projects Activity, or more affectionately known as IARPA, they do not see any conflict or redundancy in the establishment of the CIA's project. Now, guys, now, like I said, if you didn't think it could get any worse, not only do we have DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, but now we have the CIA's equivalent working on reverse engineering the brain. I mean, how horrifying. So the Machine Intelligence from Cortical Networks Program, or Microns, and I believe that is a DARPA project, that aims to reverse engineer 1 cubic millimeter of the brain, then study the way it makes computations, and then use those findings to better inform algorithms in machine learning and artificial intelligence. Oh, I guess this Microns is actually an IARPA project. I think DARPA does have that somewhere, though, mentioned. Or maybe it's the National Institute of Health. Someone does, because I've seen that acronym before. It is capital M-I-C, small r, capital O-N-S. IARPA has recruited 3 teams led by David Cox, a biologist and computer scientist at Harvard University. So again, emerging of biology and technology, as well as Tai Sing Lee, a computer scientist at where? Oh, Carnegie Mellon. Remember, Carnegie Mellon is where kind of the lizard's nest for some of this high-end connection to the federal government and artificial intelligence comes in. And that is where Mayhem, the shape-shifting immune system of the internet, out of that DARPA cyber challenge came out of, was Carnegie Mellon. And the third would be Andreas Atolias, a neuroscientist at Baylor College of Medicine. Each team has proposed its own 5-year approach to the program. So just like DARPA, 5-year little projects. It is a substantial investment because we think it is a critical challenge and it'll have a transformative impact on the intelligence community as well as the world more broadly. Microns is a part of, yes, Obama's brain initiative. Ding-a-ling is an attempt to get intelligence agencies inside your head, is what I would say, is an attempt to push forward the status quo in brain-inspired computing. A great deal of today's technology already relies on a class of algorithms called artificial neural networks, which, as their name would suggest, are inspired by the architecture of the brain. Thanks to significant increases in computing power and the availability of vast amounts of data on the internet, Facebook can identify faces, Siri can recognize voices, cars can self-navigate, and computers can beat human beings at games like chess. And yes, for the second time, the champion world player at Go. These algorithms, however, are still primitive. relying on a highly simplified process of analyzing information for patterns. Remember, I told you, being able to recognize patterns, even defined by IQ, is what they have found is tantamount to intelligence. It is not necessarily knowing everything. It's being able to put all of the pieces together to make a large puzzle. Based on models dating back to the 1980s, and I do have that DARPA book. I think I paid $4 for it in hardcover off of Amazon, printed back in like 1981, called DARPA and Neural Networks. Based on models dating back to the 1980s, neural networks tend to perform poorly in cluttered environments where the object the computer is trying to identify is hidden among a large number of objects, many of which are overlapping or ambiguous. These algorithms do not generalize well either, and seeing one or two examples of a dog, for instance, does not teach the computer yet how to identify dogs. But remember, this was written a year and a half ago. And since Google has been able to have their Google pulsating neural network, whatever they called it, be able to recognize cats. And they were using YouTube and watching cat videos to be able to do that. Humans, on the other hand, seem to overcome these challenges effortlessly. We can make out a friend in a crowd. We can focus on a familiar voice in a noisy setting and deduce patterns in sounds or an image based on just one or a handful of examples. We are constantly learning to generalize without any need for instructions. And so the Mike Rons researchers have turned to the brain to find what these models are missing. That is the smoking gun, says Cox. While neural networks retain elements of architecture found in the brain, the computations that they use are not copied directly from any algorithm that neurons use to possess information. In other words, the ways in which current algorithms represent, transform, and learn from data are engineering solutions determined largely by trial and error. Guys, are you listening to this? So they, again, are boiling down a biological processes, and this is of how the brain works, how the brain thinks, how the brain problem solves, and how the brain learns and gets smarter into a mathematical algorithm that they will be able to copy and usurp into digital form. Whether this neural processing is similar to or different from corresponding operations in the brain remains unknown. So if we go one level deeper and take information from the brain at the computational level and not just the architectural level, we can enhance these algorithms and get them closer to brain-like performance. And remember, though, this is IARPA that is doing this. Meanwhile, Lee's team plans to take a far more radical path toward mapping the connectome. And we have talked about that before. There is also a competing connectome project going on. I thought IBM might have been involved in that as well. Partnered with who? Oh, yes, Georgie Porgy Church. And when we talked a couple days about George Church, we found looking in his bio that he was connected to the Brain Initiative. Well, here it is. This is to reverse engineer the human brain with money through the CIA's IARPA. Partner with Georgie Porgy Church, a geneticist at the Harvard Medical School. Lee's team plans to use DNA barcoding. Ding! They will label every neuron with a unique sequence of nucleotides, which then becomes your barcode, and then chemically connect that barcode across synapses to reconstruct the circuit. While this method would not provide the same level of spatial information as microscopy, Lee is hoping it will be faster and more accurate providing that it works at all. That is, he says, this technology has never successfully been used before. But if this barcoding DNA technology works, yeah, we will enslave humanity. But it will also revolutionize neuroscience and connectomics. This goes on and on. While researchers agree that deriving such algorithms from the brain will be the most difficult part of microns, they will have to determine a way on how to code the brain processes information as well as form new connections, which there are several challenges persisting even in the earliest stages of the project. Phew. For one, their measurements of the brain will generate approximately 2 petabytes of data, and that is the equivalent of the memory on 250,000 laptops or 2.5 million CDs. Well, you know what? I will guarantee you that they're going to create some sort of little DNA storage device, especially if they have Georgie Porgy Church involved, and put it in a big, cool room as the pulsating, ever-growing brain. Mining information will require a process called segmentation, in which the structural elements of the neurons and their connections are all coded differently so that computers can make better sense of shared characteristics and patterns. So they're going to give each neuron basically its own IP address. Storage of such a large data set will be difficult, but guess what? IARPA, because there was a deal with the CIA, has partnered with Amazon and Jeff Bezos to find storage solutions. Well, there you go, guys. Amazon is helping the CIA and IARPA create a big pulsating brain in the cloud. So make sure you input your data every time you buy on Amazon. They are profiling you and watching what you choose and how you choose it. All right, make sure you stick around because it is Wednesday. Lonnie Clark is live up next. All kinds of live radio tonight. And I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody, take care.
On the Tracks, you can catch every Monday night and Friday night at 9 p.m. Eastern.